tonight and Friday. Temperatures cooling down a bit to allow for that snow to happen. Right now, 36, a northeast wind at 12 miles per hour. I'm David Cole, WGTD News. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next. I'm very, very pleased that the next few minutes of the morning show can be devoted to some of the greatest speeches ever delivered by American women. 75 of them are gathered together in an incredible new book called Speaking While Female. 75 extraordinary speeches by American women. This is a project by Donna Rubin, who is a journalist and a speaker and a speechwriter who has done extensive work on this particular topic and, as a matter of fact, has helped to create something called the Speaking While Female Speech Bank, which we will also be exploring. And she has put heart and soul into this book, into this collection, which dates all the way back to the mid-17th century to our present day. And although there are certainly women gathered here whose names will be very, very familiar, such as Michelle Obama and Oprah Winfrey and Hillary Clinton and Katharine Hepburn, there are also many names here that essentially none of us know, have ever heard before. And it is really, truly extraordinary that these speeches are preserved one way or another, in some cases probably quite by accident, by precious miracle that they come down to us in the present day. It's an amazing collection, diverse in many, many respects, and nothing less than inspiring. And it's published by Real Clear Publishing, and I'm very pleased to be able to speak with its author and editor, Donna Rubin. Donna Rubin, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much. It's an honor to be here.
I'm really excited that we can be talking. One of the items in your biography, your resume, is that of speechwriter. And I wonder if you could just talk for a moment about the craft of speechwriting and how your own expertise and experience in speechwriting in general is a great help to you in terms of curating a collection like this.
Yes, absolutely. I was a speechwriter for many years. I still write the odd speech now and then, but I don't do it as my main thing anymore. But speechwriting is its own unique craft. When you are writing a speech, you have to be a chief synthesizer and distiller of ideas, and you have to be able to arrange those ideas and articulate them in a way that is meant to be heard by the human ear and not read by the human eye. So you need to be attentive to all kinds of things like the sound of language, the musicality of language, the inner musicality of language, the way words will be heard by your audience. So it's a very special skill, and I have been fortunate enough, honored to be a judge for the Cicero Speech Writing Contest every year for probably the last decade. And that really was the inciting incident, as they say in the movie world. That was what really led to the creation of my Women's Speech Project, because I began learning about speech craft.
Hmm. So tell us, before we start digging into the book, Speaking While Female, about this so-called speech bank that you have helped to create. Tell us exactly what that is and what prompted you to create it.
Yeah, well, it was when I was working as a speech writer full-time that, and as I said, as a judge for speech writing contests, that I began to be aware of how often people were quoting Winston Churchill. I mean, it was really quite incredible. It seems like every time I would read a speech, there'd be a quote from Winston Churchill. Now, Winston Churchill was a great orator. He was obviously a British statesman and, you know, the 19th century, and quite an esteemed speaker. But did he merit being quoted in every speech that I was reading? I thought, no, something's got to be wrong with this. So I started researching, who did people associate with oratory? When we talk about great speakers of the past, who do we think of? And come to find out, it was almost always a man. If you stop anybody in the street and ask them, who were the great speakers in American history, they will tell you Patrick Henry. They'll mention Abe Lincoln. They'll mention Kennedy, JFK, RFK, Martin Luther King. They'll mention Frederick Douglass. But they will not mention a woman. If they mention a woman, if they do happen to mention a woman, it's always a woman such as Michelle Obama or Oprah Winfrey. Maybe Sojourner Truth. Maybe a Shirley Chisholm. But it's almost like there's a complete vacuum of information or knowledge about the fact that women have been great speakers too. So that was the catalyst for me.
One of the things that you say in the introduction, and I think you say it very well, is the fact that one of the reasons why there is that attitude with the typical person on the street, I was going to say man on the street, even a woman on the street might be inclined to share that very same opinion. That is, when it comes to the great orators of history, of American history, the names that will immediately come to mind are that of men. Rather than women, and part of the reason for that, of course, is the fact that for so many years, for generations, in fact, it was men who were caretakers of, in a sense, the historical record, and they had the guiding hand in what was, in a sense, preserved and talked about and venerated, and even thundering, glorious speeches delivered by women often in the moment were not appreciated, and certainly in hindsight were not appreciated either.
I think that's true. I mean, I think what you're alluding to is this idea that history is written by the victors or those in power. And we do know that, of course, for most of our nation's history, for the most of the nearly four centuries of American history, it has been men who have held positions of authority and power. So men held legislative power, men had constitutional power, men had, there were military leaders. And it wasn't until more or less the 1960s and the 1970s that a new kind of historical research arose called social history, in which we really started to appreciate that history is not only made by the people at the top, but history is made by people all throughout a society. And of course, that includes people in the economic bottom tier. It includes women. It includes people of color, people who were disenfranchised. So it really wasn't until about 50 years ago that we even began to start thinking about the fact that women's voices mattered too.
Your introduction actually begins with a very, very poignant story about something said by a woman, and I don't believe we even know her first name, something which occurred at a church in Manhattan. Tell our listeners about this brief story that you tell and why it is with this that you begin your book.
Well, Miss Pollyon was a black woman, and she had been enslaved, and she made her way to the North and entered into a church to tell her story. And she talked about what an arduous journey she had made along the Underground Railroad, presumably, to get to freedom, to get to the North. And before she left New York, she was stepping on a boat the next, I think it was the next day, the next week, she was going to Haiti. She told her story. And how valuable that story would have been. Don't we wish we could have heard the words that she used to describe the suffering and also the bravery, the courage that it took for her to travel from the South to the North. But unfortunately, all we have is one, a few lines that refer to a Miss Pollyon who spoke in the church last night. It's just one example that I use in the book of a woman's words who were not accorded enough respect and appreciation to have captured her exact language. And as I point out in the book, if there was no journalist sent to cover a woman speaker, if an editor in his office decided not to send a journalist to cover that event, then that woman's words were not going to appear in the newspaper the next day. They were not going to be quoted and quoted in different articles and different venues. They certainly were not going to appear in any anthology collected and published through the years. And, of course, we're not going to be remembering those words in our history books today. So that's the consequence of not writing down and remembering what women said.
We're speaking with Donna Rubin about her new book, Speaking While Female. 75 Extraordinary Speeches by American Women. The subtitle really says it all, but does not probably even adequately convey just the scope and breadth of what is collected here. These speeches range far and wide in terms of topic, and many of them are of thundering intensity and just glorious examples of eloquence and rhetoric at its very, very best. So talk for a moment about the process of gathering these speeches, of finding these speeches, of trying to sort of uncover what has been hidden for so long. Not that every one of these speeches is that sort of thing. I mean, some of them are justly famous, but then there are others that I'm sure have probably scarcely seen the light of day since they were initially delivered. Talk about the process, what I'm sure was a painstaking, arduous process of assembling these 75 speeches, of choosing them, and in a sense of finding some of them in the first place.
Right. It has been a real labor of love. So you referred earlier to my speech bank, and let me explain what that is. When I first realized the extent to which women's voices in history had been excluded and overlooked and not part of the history book, the historical narrative, I started doing an immense amount of research into women's speech, and I started putting all the speeches that I found onto one website. It's called the Speaking While Female Speech Bank, and that is a free resource. Everybody can go there, and I hope everybody will go there, including women and girls, students, who can use this resource as part of their studies, as part of their education, and so that they can be inspired by all the women from all around the world and from even as far back as ancient times in the Roman world. There are examples of women speaking. So that was my base source when I started to work on the American Women's Speech Project. I started with the Speaking While Female Speech Bank, which had speeches by women from all over the world, and I created an Excel spreadsheet, and I started filling in women from American history. So this collection starts in 1637 in the Puritan era and goes all the way up to 2021. That's nearly 400 years of American women speaking.
Wow. And, of course, I should think choosing 75 to constitute this particular book was probably not an easy matter. I mean, there were probably many more that you probably wish could be part of this.
Oh, for sure. So when I started this project, in the very, very early days, I had talked about a collection. It sounds absurd now, but I talked about a collection with 35 speeches. Well, pretty soon, like within a few days, we went to 50. And then I held a Kickstarter campaign last year to crowdsource funds for the project, for the research in the project, and I did that with 50 speeches in mind. But when I sat down a year ago to actually pick the 50 speeches, and I created that Excel spreadsheet, pretty soon it became obvious to me that there is no way that I could tell the sweep of American history and reflect the diversity of voices in American history of women speaking with 50 speeches. And that's when I expanded it to 75. And let me make one more point. You referred earlier to the fact that some of these speeches haven't been part of our historical record. Two of the speeches, as far as I know, two of the speeches in this collection have never been published before. There's nowhere else that you can find them in a published form except for here on this, in this book. And at least one other speech in the collection hasn't been published in over a century. So it really has been a process for me of old gumshoe research, as they used to say, just digging through the research, writing to archives, in some cases physically going to archives, but that wasn't easy during the pandemic, but just doing the hard research of digging out these speeches that would be a representative portrayal of the diversity of voices that have contributed to the nation that we know it, really contributed to the creation and the making of America.
Let me ask you one somewhat delicate question, and that is that, and I want to reassert that this is an incredibly diverse group, and I think you've chosen well. I really love this book start to finish. I could imagine somebody picking up this book and hoping that they might see a name like, I don't know, Phyllis Schlafly or Anita Bryant or somebody who probably gave good, effective speeches, but perhaps with a message that you, for instance, might not be really comfortable including in this collection. I wonder how much you kind of thought about that. And in a sense, are there any speeches here that kind of rub against you on kind of a personal level in terms of what they say or the views that they espouse? I'm guessing not, but I'm just wondering if you wrestled with that at all. I mean, that if the inclusiveness of this collection could have also included speeches that espoused views or perspectives that are maybe at odds with your own or maybe with the vast majority of what is gathered here. I'm not sure if that's a clear question or not.
No, it's a very clear question. It's a fair question, and it's a good question, and I'm glad you asked it. I struggled, as did my editors, mightily with the whole question of inclusivity. And let me just say, first of all, that from a racial and from a ethnic point of view, this is the most diverse collection that you could imagine. I have, out of 75 speeches, I have 18 speeches by Black women. I have, I think, 5 speeches by Indigenous or Native American women. I have speeches by Latina women, Hispanic women. I have speeches by Asian American women. And I have one speech by a woman speaking out for so-called lesbian rights. That's what they called it in 1972. That was Madeline Davis. And I have Judy Heumann speaking out for disability rights. I have Temple Grandin speaking out for neurodiversity. So from that perspective, it is the most diverse representation of women's voices. But your question particularly was about ideological diversity. I think it's fair to say that anybody who talked to me for a few minutes would know that I lean to the left. I am a liberal Democrat, but I strove very hard to create a kind of representative perspective on American points of view. And I did think long and hard about including a speech by Phyllis Schlafly. I looked at her speeches. Indeed, I have her speeches in my speech bank, in the online speech bank. I have a number of speeches by Phyllis Schlafly. But in the end, I didn't include any of those. I just didn't find the right one, and it just didn't fit into the time frame. But it wasn't because I was afraid or reluctant to have opposing points of view. I feel really strongly that as a nation, we excel when we have diverse points of view in the public sphere. And that means points of view from all over the spectrum. You know, in my spare time, I'm a debate judge. I debate high school forensic competitions. And that's a venue where young people engage in the clash of ideas. In Lincoln Douglas debate, the important value is a good clash of ideas. And I believe that's the best way to let the best idea rise to the top. So indeed, there are women in this collection who were Republicans, who were from the right side of the aisle, but I didn't include anybody whose point of view I really strongly disagreed with. I would say that everybody in this collection articulated a point of view that I respected and thought was well-serving America in that time period.
Mm. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Donna Rubin, who is responsible for a marvelous and fascinating new book called Speaking While Female, 75 Extraordinary Speeches by American Women. Indeed, the scope of this book is impressive, not just in terms of the diversity of voices and background of those whom we hear from, but also the fact that the latest speech is from 2021. The first item in your book, although not exactly a speech, dates all the way back to 1637. And indeed, I think you've really done something intriguing in terms of the first couple of items that are collected here that allow us to hear from some very early women, even if what we are hearing from them is not, at least in the purest sense of the word, a speech. I wonder if you could just explain the presence of, for instance, Anne Hutchinson and Margaret Brent in your book.
Yeah, and I actually beg to differ with you. I believe, to my knowledge, that Anne Hutchinson's words that are in this anthology were her own words. Those are the words that have been captured in the early Massachusetts Bay Colony records. So those are the words that Anne Hutchinson used when she preached in her home on the Shawmut. Those are the words from her trial, pardon me.
Right.
She was put on trial. Anne Hutchinson was ministering to her community on the Shawmut Peninsula at a time when the leaders of the Puritan colony disapproved or did not sanction women to be preachers. And she did it anyway. She did it in her home, and she was put on trial, and the words that we have in this book are her own words. So they absolutely are a speech. I mean, a public testimony is a form of speech. And for your listeners who don't know, because of what she did, Anne Hutchinson and her family were banished from the Massachusetts Bay Colony. They went down the coast. They moved to what's now now the state of Rhode Island, and then to New York, where they were later murdered. But that's a whole other story. So the words are an actual speech. But then you mentioned the second one in the book, which is Margaret Brent. Suppose, technically speaking, you might say that's not a speech. What we have are her recorded words through someone else's explanation of them. Margaret Brent went in the Maryland, now we're down in Maryland, in the Maryland colony in 1648 in a civil court in St. Mary's, the city of St. Mary's, and asked the legislature for a voice and a vote. So we know that she asked for a voice and a vote, so I consider those her actual words. But unfortunately, that's all we have from her, is just one line. So that's a situation in which I suppose you might say we don't actually have her speech, but it's so important that she stood up and spoke out in a public venue and asked for voice and vote. And some people consider Margaret Brent the first female lawyer in America.
Hmm. I am really glad that this is here. I mean, I'm glad both of them are here. And in this case, this is something that occurred back in 1648. And one thing that is striking about the way this is presented to us on the page is First of all of the original spellings are there. So, many of the words not spelled the way we spell them now, but it's, in a sense, just one stark sentence. Came Mrs. Margaret Brent and requested to have vote in the House for herself and voice also. And that's it. And the rest of the page is just blank white space. And I really think that's a very powerful image, because it speaks to, in a sense, the fate that has befallen so many women, particularly in our early history, that this is all that comes down to us. And it just makes us mindful of, in a sense, all that has been lost.
That's very beautiful. I actually hadn't thought about the blank page that way. My own mother, who's 93, got her copy of the book fresh off the hot off the press, and she looked at that entry and she thought there was a mistake. She said, why isn't there any more information on this page? And I said, because those are the only words we have from Margaret Brent from 1648. She asked for a voice and a vote.
One of my favorites from the early part of the book is a woman I've never heard of before by the name of Priscilla Mason, who speaks to a group in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, in the spring of 1793. Maybe you could just say a word about this gathering to which she spoke and what you find so very stirring about what she had to say on this early date.
Well, Priscilla Mason was a young woman. She was almost certainly a teenager. We don't know her exact age. And she was graduating from the Philadelphia Ladies Academy. That was one of the earliest, if not the earliest, institutions of education for women in the New World. And at that time, of course, it was thought appropriate for young boys to be educated, but girls didn't need an education. It would have been a waste to educate girls for the life that they were expected to lead in the home, in the domestic sphere. So very typically, girls got very early training in reading and writing and not much beyond that. So Priscilla Mason was a student at the Philadelphia Ladies Academy. It would have been a school for young women whose parents could afford to send them there. It was a private school. And in 1793, they had their graduation ceremony. Priscilla Mason stood up and gave the graduation speech. It's called, we call it the salutary oration. Salutary in the sense of meaning healthy or well-hearty, well-meant, well-intentioned oration or speech. And in that speech, she makes a very passionate plea for young girls and young women to be taught the skills of oration, to be taught how to speak in public just like men, just like her male counterparts. And she goes even beyond that, and she calls for, she makes an argument that with those skills of public speaking, women would be allowed to participate in all the public realms that men do, in the law, in public service, in community life. So it really is quite a revolutionary speech. She made it at the graduation ceremony at a church in Philadelphia, and in the audience would have been her fellow students, all the teachers and administrators of her school. There would have been parents of the graduates there, and there would have been townspeople there too, members of the community. So she used that very public occasion to make a passionate plea for a greater role for women in society.
My favorite part of this wonderful speech is when she says, "Our high and mighty lords," and by that she's referring to the male leadership of America, "our high and mighty lords, thanks to their arbitrary constitutions, have denied us the means of knowledge and then reproached us for the want of it." In other words, men have, in a sense, conspired to prevent women from receiving a proper education and then deride them for not being properly educated, when, in fact, it is due to their policies and their prejudices that such a situation exists. I mean, she's not only correct, but she says it so very, very well.
Right. She says it in 1793. And, you know, this has been happening for much of American history. Women get criticized. They're the recipients of criticism for all kinds of things, even when they're have been denied the ability to learn and gain aptitude and skills in those areas. Women were criticized for not being good speakers, for not being good leaders throughout this was the 1700s, throughout the 1800s and 1900s. Women weren't capable of leaderly qualities. Women's voices were irritating. Women were dressed inappropriately for leadership. I mean, the hypocrisy is quite evident. And all this just makes me very proud and grateful for all these women who came before us and laid the groundwork, and for the fact that we do live in this day and age when women do have the means and are accorded the privileges to step up and use our voices and be leaders in our community. It's not a given.
Not at all.
Wasn't that for women before us, and we should never take it for granted.
Absolutely. It brings to mind another wonderful speech in your book from it would be about 25 years later, delivered by one Emma Willard, speaking to members of the New York State Legislature, again on the topic of improving female education. And one of the things I so appreciate about this speech, and not only the truth of what she's saying, but also the wisdom with which she says it in terms of trying to be persuasive, is when she poses this question: where is that wise and heroic country which has considered that our rights are sacred, though we cannot defend them? That, though a weaker, we are an essential part of the body politic. But part of what she's saying there is that any country that is not barbaric, a country that is wise and truly heroic, surely is capable of something better than what they are at that point in time delivering to the women of their population. I mean, I think that's a very eloquent argument to make.
It is. It is. It actually sends chills down my spine. And I'm still moved profoundly by these speeches when I read through them and when I think about the biography of these women's lives. And, of course, this book is only meant to be an introduction. I hope that this book will be used in classrooms across America as a kind of adjunct or kind of companion to the traditional textbooks, the social studies, and the history textbooks that have left out women's voices. But each of these women have their biographies and their lives are worth digging into deeper and learning about, because it's only when you understand them in context that you're able to appreciate how challenging it was, what an uphill climb it was for them to step out of the traditional role accorded for women and do the thing that was not sanctioned, that they were criticized for, and that was speaking in public. Mm. I mean, these women had a very hard time. So many of them were criticized, their reputation. Many of them were in the press, were criticized in the press. They were called whores and prostitutes. It was thought, how could a woman even be speaking in public unless she was a woman of ill repute and low moral standards? Some of the women had objects, projectiles thrown at them while they were speaking. One time, Lucy Stone, in the middle of a speech, someone took a hose and poured cold water over her while she was speaking. And as her daughter reports, she just tightened her shawl around her and kept speaking. Mm. I mean, it's really incredible what these women experienced. Fanny Wright was so unpopular by certain parts of society because she was a speaker that people would come and protest in front of her speeches. And one time somebody cut off the gas, and the whole hall was plunged into darkness. I mean, what these women endured just for using their voices is absolutely horrifying.
Absolutely. And I'm so glad you mentioned that, and it's a point that is mentioned again and again, and with good reason. It brings to mind a wonderful speech delivered by one Lucretia Mott, a Quaker minister. This is in 1849. And this is, there's a moment in this wonderful speech in which she kind of talks about this whole matter of the men who would ridicule a woman standing and delivering a speech. And she says, "There is nothing of greater importance to the well-being of society at large, of men as well as women, than the true and proper position of women. Much has been said from time to time upon this subject. It has been the theme for ridicule, for satire and sarcasm. We might look for this from the ignorant and vulgar, but from the intelligent and refined, we have a right to expect that such weapons shall not be resorted to." Right. I mean, that really, it's like calling upon the men of her day and their better angels. I mean, to be the best that they can be and to be the proper, morally upright men that they, I'm sure, proclaim themselves to be, but would sometimes not demonstrate in terms of their actions.
Well, here's something interesting about Lucretia Mott. She was a Quaker, and she was staunchly, ardently an abolitionist against slavery. And she traveled to London for the famous, in 1840, for the famous abolitionist gathering, the World Anti-Slavery Gathering. And she was an official delegate. She was sent there as a delegate, and because she was a woman, she was forced to sit in the galleys in the periphery and not allowed to speak. And it was that experience, that occasion when she met Elizabeth Cady Stanton. And Elizabeth Cady Stanton was on her honeymoon, and she and her husband, they were both American women, and they had traveled across the ocean to England, to London, for this conference. And Elizabeth Cady Stanton was so incensed at the treatment that Lucretia Mott received during that convention that they sat together and they talked about the possibility of convening in America a conference for women's rights. And 8 years later, that was the gathering that became the famous Seneca Falls Convention for Women, for women's rights.
That's where it all, in a sense, began. I am reminded something you said about the wonderful speech delivered on the 4th of July, 1828, by one Frances Wright, in which I think she is so wise to speak to the whole topic of change and the fact that so many people seem to be predisposed to fearing change. And of course, that's part of what these women, courageous enough to get up and speak in public, were facing, is a certain wide swath of the population that just could not tolerate the thought of widespread change. And this is what she says in this speech, again, on July 4th, 1828. "Let us not be afraid of change. Speak of change and the world is in an uproar. And yet, where do we not see change? What is there in the physical world but change? And where would we be in the moral world without change? The flower blossoms, the fruit ripens, the seed is received and germinates in the earth, and we behold it. The aliment we eat to satisfy our hunger incorporates within our frame, and the atoms composing our existence today are exhaled tomorrow. In like manner, our feelings and opinions are molded by circumstances and matured by observation and experience. All is change. Within and about us, no one thing is as it was or will be as it is." I mean, that just speaks right to the heart of, we cannot be afraid of change. It is an inescapable part of life. And it's just a shame that more people didn't take to heart these eloquent words by Frances Wright.
Right. She was a radical. I mean, she really was quite a radical in her thought. But in that passage that you cite, in her appreciation of change, she actually espouses views that are quite ancient. I mean, ancient Buddhism is predicated on just that notion of constant change. The world is constantly changing and evolving. And when we appreciate that in the most profound sense, then we understand that it's incumbent upon each of us as agents, as moral agents, and as agentive people with the ability to influence the world around us for the better. Fanny Wright was a fascinating woman. She was Scottish by birth. So she was not born here in America, but she became a citizen, an American citizen. She came here because she was so deeply impressed by the ideals of the American Revolution and the concept of natural rights. And she came to this country, and she spent her life here, and she worked hard to make this a better country. In fact, she worked very hard to find ways to promote abolition and to end slavery.
Fascinating. We need to take a moment to talk about Sojourner Truth. That will be one of the most familiar names from the earlier excerpts in this book. And you've made a really fascinating choice when it comes to the single most famous speech that Sojourner Truth ever delivered. Explain to our listeners the choice that you have made to share, in a sense, two different versions of this famous moment from her life and career.
Right. Well, Sojourner Truth happened to be traveling in Western New York in 1851, and she went over into Akron, Ohio, where there was a women's conference taking place, a women's rights conference. And she stepped up to the platform and gave a speech that was recorded in the newspaper within a week by a friend of hers who happened to be publisher of a newspaper. But some 12 years later, her speech was reprinted in a different manner. It was reprinted as the speech that we have come to recognize today as Ain't I a Woman. And that speech was delivered in the kind of vernacular speech that we associate with people of the South, kind of a vernacular speech pattern that we sometimes associate with black people in the South. And we don't exactly know why that choice was made. It could be because it was considered that she would fit in more with stereotypical ideas of a black Southern person, but it couldn't have been farther from the truth, because Sojourner Truth came from upstate New York. Her original language was a form of Dutch. They called it Low Dutch. She also spoke English, and she wouldn't have spoken with a Southern accent. She just never would have spoken with a Southern accent. But the original speech, Ain't I a Woman, became so famous that it has been celebrated through the centuries. In fact, it's in school primers. It's been delivered at graduation speeches. People have taken it up as a rallying cry, Ain't I a Woman? And it wasn't until quite recently that we have come to appreciate that the original version was completely different. And that version is called I Am a Woman's Rights. So in this volume, I've chosen to put both speeches side by side. One is the traditional version that all of us have grown up with and are familiar with that repeating line, Ain't I a Woman? Ain't I a Woman? Ain't I a Woman? And next to it, we have the version that we now believe is the authentic one, I Am a Woman's Rights.
In our last couple of minutes, I want us to touch briefly on just a couple of other later speeches, but we just want to remind people that we find in the book Carrie Nation and Susan B. Anthony and Gloria Steinem and Katharine Hepburn and Helen Keller. I mean, it is a cavalcade of amazing women, one after another. One of our local community theaters at the moment is presenting the play Raisin in the Sun by Lorraine Hansberry. So I wonder if you could just talk for a moment about the excerpt that you have included from Lorraine Hansberry in your book.
Yeah, I'm glad to know they're putting on that production. In fact, there's a production taking place right now in Brooklyn, New York, here near where I live, of a play by Lorraine Hansberry. So the speech that I've included in this collection is one that has very seldom been reproduced. It's called "The Nation Needs Your Gifts." But one of the lines in that speech was about talented black voices. So Lorraine Hansberry participated near the end of her life in a competition led by Reader's Digest. And a small group of students entered their writing samples and were chosen as winners of this award. And Lorraine Hansberry went to New York and went to Manhattan. She lived not far from me here in Croton-on-Hudson, New York. And she went to the city and delivered this speech telling these students why they needed to use their voices. They would have been young black students. And she was telling them, the nation needs your gifts. You are young, talented, and black. And she said that in the speech, you are young, talented, and black. She also said, in the vernacular of the day, you are young, talented, and Negro. And the nation needs your gifts. The nation needs to know black history. And that's an appropriate theme for us today because we're just ending Black History Month and moving into Women's History Month. So this speech hits both themes. Lorraine Hansberry was a very passionate and articulate voice for women's rights, for black rights, for civil rights and human rights. And sadly, she died not long after this speech was delivered. She died quite young of cancer. And I have visited her gravesite a number of times. As I said, it's not far from where I live. And it's always moving to me because on top of her grave, the grave is in Croton-on-Hudson, New York, and on top of the grave site, people leave pencils and pens as a commemoration of her written word, as her gifts as a writer and a user of the English language in such a powerful way.
Wow, that's a beautiful, beautiful tribute. I'm so happy to hear that, and I indeed am very happy that this is here, and everything else that is part of your amazing book. Once again, the book gathers together 75 different speeches by gifted women over the generations, and each entry includes a well-written introduction that tells us about the woman in question and the circumstances under which the speech was delivered. The book, again, is Speaking While Female, 75 Extraordinary Speeches by American Women, published by Real Clear Publishing, and the author, Donna Rubin. Donna Rubin, thank you so much for giving the world this truly important book, and thank you for being my morning show guest today. I was honored to speak with you.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, a follow-up to today's interview, I'll be sharing with you recorded excerpts from 5 of the extraordinary speeches highlighted in Donna Rubin's book. So we'll be hearing from Katharine Hepburn, Barbara Jordan, from Mary Fisher, Michelle Obama, and Oprah Winfrey. And you'll hear excerpts from the thoughtfully written introductions that Donna Rubin has written for each of the speeches collected in her marvelous book, Speaking While Female. That's tomorrow on The Morning Show. Nan Calvert, by the way, joins us for her monthly visit to The Morning Show on Thursday. Our weather forecast today calls for mostly sunny skies and a high of 41 degrees. increasing cloudiness overnight with a low of 32. Tomorrow should be yet again a mostly sunny day with a high of 38 degrees, with increasing clouds on Thursday, and then rain and snow moving in Thursday night and into Friday. In fact, several inches of snow accumulation are possible by Friday. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, NPR.